Welcome to episode 40 of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. As you know, I have a very keen interest in the history of photography, as you might imagine, and I'll always take the opportunity to speak with anyone who is an authority on the background to our wonderful art. On this week's show then, I'm in conversation with Roger Watson, who is curator at Laycock Abbey in Wiltshire, the one-time home of photography's pioneer William Henry Fox Talbot. In this first of two parts, we're stood inside the Fox Talbot Museum, talking about the man's background and his activities as a photographer and much more besides. So, welcome, one and all, to The Active Photographer, episode 40. Today I'm very fortunate to be with Roger Watson at Laycock Abbey in the lovely village of Laycock here in Wiltshire in the UK. And Roger is the curator of the Fox Talbot Museum here at Laycock. And so good morning, first of all, Roger.
Good morning, Giles. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. And we are actually stood here in one section of the museum. As I look in front of me, I'm surrounded by vintage cameras, and I use the term vintage very sort of broadly. It's a bit of a buzzword these days. Mm-hmm. But then we've also got examples of photographs, early imaging, references to the inventors of photography as we see it and think of it nowadays. Roger, let's just I'll take your lead first of all. Let's just talk about what is Laycock and Fox Talbot, who he was and why this place is so important to him and the development of photography from the early years.
Okay. Well, Fox Talbot is identified specifically with Laycock and Laycock Abbey, and his family has owned the abbey and the village as well since the 16th century. So it's not surprising. Although Talbot himself didn't live here until he was 27 years old. There were certain debts that had to be cleared before the property could be moved into, those sorts of things. So he didn't move in until he was 27. But all of his photographic experiments were done here at Laycock. He did go far afield to photograph. He went to Oxford and London in England, but he also went to Belgium, France, and places like that. So.
And it's interesting in terms of, it's probably just worth mentioning this, obviously there's a visitor centre here and the National Trust obviously getting involved is a National Trust property. How did that, we're jumping forward of course, but how did that come about to guarantee the continuation of the Fox Talbot name and securing this collection for the future and for visitors?
Well, Laycock was always seen as a bit of a backwater. Talbot's granddaughter, Matilda Talbot, was in the process of moving the collection to various other museums. In the 1930s, she had the Science Museum, the Royal Photographic Society, and the Royal Scottish Museum all come in, and they were allowed to take whatever they wanted for their own collection. She was determined to promote her grandfather's work, but she didn't see Laycock as being a likely visiting spot. Mm. That was probably the one thing she got wrong. We're visited fairly heavily. We get about 140,000 visitors a year through the museum and the abbey, so quite good.
And we were just talking beforehand about where visitors come from. Now, I know, as well as you do, there's a great interest from the States with the history of photography. A gentleman that I sometimes talk to, Jeff Curto, who is a lecturer, a tutor in the States about the history of photography, he cites Talbot and Laycock as a reference. The village itself, you were just saying, has been used in a number of big films such as Harry Potter. Can you give us some other examples that people would maybe not know that it was Laycock, but they will have inadvertently seen the village?
Oh, the Pride and Prejudice with Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy. Mm-hmm. The village of Meryton was the village of Laycock, actually. And Cranford, which was on television the last couple of years, with Dame Judi Dench, the village of Laycock was Cranford. So we get a lot of that, and we do get a lot of visitors specifically because of the filming that's gone on here. And that's okay. I don't mind if they don't come knowing about Talbot and about photography, but I'm determined that once they get here, they're going to know something about it by the time they leave.
And that's, I think that leads us nicely on to talking about how it all began, because some people might be aware of the name. I think it's very easy to think about old photography, the inventors of photography. People immediately think of sepia prints, as yes. We would see photographic prints. But of course, for Talbot, it was just a progression, an idea, because he was using the camera obscura process as an aid to his drawing.
Right.
So how did the process begin with what we consider a negative and a print? How did that come about for Talbot?
He was on his honeymoon, actually, in Italy in 1833, and he was trying to draw using the camera lucida and the camera obscura, and found that his efforts were pretty awful. Actually, he called his drawings melancholy to behold. I think that's pretty accurate. And his wife and his sister were both there at the time, and they both could draw and paint quite well. So it got him thinking about how could he use science, which was his great interest, to aid the artist in making images. And so he came up with the idea that if we worked with light-sensitive materials, we might be able to get the camera obscura to record its images.
And was it the case that he was actually in quite a privileged position because he was very well-learned, he was of a certain standing in society? Was it that it enabled him to indulge himself in the process? And obviously the investment in both time and financial investment that allowed him to make these experiments.
It is to a certain extent. Most people don't realize that the idea that silver salts, in particular silver chloride, will change upon exposure to light, that was actually a fairly commonly known thing in the early 19th, late 18th century. And so it wasn't a far stretch for him to begin his process that way. But it does take time, it does take money, and it does take an interest to do it. And he had all three at the time, so he was in quite good place to do it. Why photography wasn't invented earlier is always the question that strikes me, and I still don't have a good answer to that. If the camera had been around 1,000 years, the chemistry had been around for at least 100 years, and yet nobody had pulled it together. Now, a lot of them had experimented, and they came up against two obstacles. One was that the tones were reversed, so dark was light and light was dark, and they came up against the fact that they couldn't get the paper to stop turning dark after they'd made the exposure.
So which in modern times we would think in terms of the fixative, the traditional development process, you have to physically halt that process, of course.
Yeah. You have to desensitize the silver somehow so it stops changing.
Yeah.
And those were the two things that he came across, and he conquered both of them very quickly. He was the first really to see that having the tones reversed was not a problem, but actually a good solution to things, because he liked the idea that you could take a negative, and from a negative you could make multiple prints. And the fixing, that was a little more a bit of scientific deduction. He looked at some of the experiments he was doing and noticed that different parts of the paper would develop up in a different way, or that would come up in a different way, and he deduced from that it had to do with the strength of the salt solution, basically, that he was using.
And this, for as a time reference, I'm actually thinking is around 1835, something around
34. He began his experiments. 35, August of 1835, was when he made the first in-camera negative that still exists, which is the latticed window, or aureole window negative.
And I think perhaps, if it's possible, maybe we could take a stroll over there at some point today and have a chat about that. But if we just sort of take a step over here, what we've got in front of us, and this is with the information panel here that talks of the other inventors of photography, we have a fern here. It's sort of what we would call today, or think closely as being, a photogram, where essentially you are resting an object on a piece of light-sensitive paper, as it would be now, exposing that paper to light, and it creates this block outline. But of course, that is a modern-day interpretation. We might do that sander and enlarger, but of course, Fox Talbot was using daylight for this process.
Right. Well, it starts out, we think of it in terms of the more abstract work that Man Ray and people like that did. But from Talbot's point of view, for certain things, in particular botanical specimens, this was actually as good, if not better, than photographing them with the camera, because you were getting everything to scale and complete and specific dimensions, and you could work from those. So I don't think he saw this as a particularly an intermediate step. The same with working with lace and other very flat objects like that. You could create a very direct, very specific copy of the object in question. But he did know, he did think that the idea of working with the camera was definitely the direction that he wanted to go in.
And so, just as a, out of interest then, his work, his drawings and that side of thing, did he continue to do those in the same level, or did this just consume his passion, his interest? Did he sort of, sketches were just something he did at the side, and all his time was playing with this new technology that he'd stumbled upon?
That's a good question. I don't think anybody's asked me that before. I've never seen a drawing by Talbot after the date of photography. It wasn't like that for everybody. Sir John Herschel, who was a great advocate of photography and loved photography dearly, also was very adept at drawing with a camera Lucida.
Yeah.
And he went on drawing with a camera Lucida into the 1860s. So
I suppose it's a bit like now, you know, thinking right forward to the modern day. Everyone thinks about digital. The next generation of students that are coming through the schools and colleges, they should hopefully be encouraged to use film cameras because, A, it's cheap to be able to process film, what have you. But that is the current technology that we have. Professionally, certainly so many people don't shoot film because the new technology is this digital. And it's almost as if at each stage, the older technology almost goes by the wayside and people forget that it can actually contribute to the future as well as the present.
Well, I was at George Eastman House for a number of years. I worked there before I came to Laycock. And Kodak had an old slogan, which was innovation drives sales. And that just means if you change it, people will buy it. And photography over time has become faster, cheaper, easier. But it hasn't necessarily gotten better. I mean, a good calotype or a good daguerreotype beats a modern digital print in a lot of ways. And really, my favorite color process is the autochrome, which is from around 1903. And I think the colors in that are really the most beautiful that you've done. But we've done it faster, cheaper, better, supposedly, since then. Better is one of those odd terms. It's undefinable in this
term. Absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned that. Regular listeners will know that I was actually over at Dimbola Lodge on the Isle of Wight, one time home of Julia Margaret Cameron, one of the other pioneers of photography. Amongst her personal friends, we had the likes of Darwin, Tennyson, people that she photographed and what have you. Now, a lot of people, again, look at those older pictures and they assume that, you know, sort of in inverted commas, old photographs have to be slightly out of focus, a little bit rough around the edges. She had the technology to have razor-sharp pictures. She just defaced the lenses. We would recommend using maybe a filter in front of the lens these days, but she was actually etching onto the lenses to create, not all of them. There are some examples where they are, you know, nice and crisp. But I was visiting the National Portrait Gallery some years ago, and there was an exhibition called The Beautiful and the Damned, I think it was called, which you may recall. And it was these photographs of, from what we would call insane asylums, people with electric shock therapy. But these were modern, some of them were modern day prints made from glass negatives. They were absolutely razor sharp. They would rival anything that a modern day camera, with all this benefit of hindsight and history. And it just goes to show that, it, like you said, isn't always an improvement on what's come before.
There never was a process in terms of grain structure and resolution to beat the wet collodion process. It was always the sharpest of photographic processes. You could take a wet plate negative and blow it up to the size of a billboard, and you still aren't seeing grain in it.
Yeah.
So it's quite amazing. So, yeah, she could have done that. But she came out of a tradition of Romanticism, and the Pre-Raphaelites were friends of hers as well. So she was looking at the ethereal nature of memory and the ethereal nature of myth. And so I think that the style of work that she did suited that. But yeah, she's gotten more publicity and more prominence than a lot of other 19th century photographers. So people do seem to think that everybody's a little bit fuzzy and a little bit soft. Yeah.
And what after the initial discovery and the initial experimentation, what was Fox Talbot's sort of I say focus, and it's an obvious word to use, but what was his direction? You were saying about Julia Margaret having this romanticism. What was it, more of a scientific background to what pushed Fox Talbot to continue his studies and the experimentation?
Well, he was looking at perfecting the process, which to him meant sharper images, faster, shorter exposures, and easier printing, those sorts of things. So he was not really working in the direction of Cameron at all. His photographs have an artistic quality to them, but quite different. They're rather more formal. They're rather more academic sorts of views and things like that. Though there's nothing wrong with that, and there's good tradition for those in the 19th century as well. But quite different. But no, I don't think he wanted to soften the image or make it look less like a photograph. He was trying to make it look as much like a photograph as possible.
And what were obviously friends and family very close to any creation of an idea or development, but his contemporaries, was it encouraged? Was he considered in some sort of awe? Was it did it increase his standing, or was it a little bit sort of witchcrafty, a little bit kind of people weren't quite sure what to make of it?
I think photography should have increased his stature. It was an important invention. It was an important step forward, but because of the press, he was always the Johnny Come Lately. It was all Daguerre. It was no Talbot. Sir John Herschel thought very highly of Talbot, and liked his process very much. He also liked the daguerreotype. Sir David Brewster was another one who was a great Talbot fan, and actually the calotype process probably did better in Scotland than it did in England.
Right.
Part of that is always blamed on the patent issue, but the daguerreotype was patented too. Nobody seemed to complain about that.
But there's like, I suppose in the modern day, there's always this rush to be first to create, to have your name stamped on an achievement of any kind, whether it's in modern days, whether it's a world record or a development of a new technology, finding a cure for something. Yeah. I don't think that's really changed since those days, but it's, as you say, you know, with the whole kind of Pride and Prejudice and people think of period dramas, there is a romanticized idea. And I always like to think it's very easy from our modern day position to look back with a slightly sort of hazy view of the world, but to actually imagine what it was at that time. That's why, say, a lot has been said about the process, the self, the technology, but that's why I'm always interested in what other people were thinking at the time. You know, let's have a little sort of wonder. Perhaps you can sort of show me something along here that is of note in front of us, something that really stands out.
Well, we try and paint a broader picture of Talbot here, and not just his photographic achievements, because he was really fairly well known in the scientific community. He was an active member of the British Association for the Advancement of Science. He was a fellow of the Royal Society and a member of the Royal Institution. And he did conduct a lot of other experiments. As a matter of fact, his fellowship at the Royal Society came not from photographic work, but it came from some papers he wrote on mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
So he was what's generally termed a polymath, which means he had interests in a lot of different areas. So you end up with some of the equipment here, which involves some of the early experiments in electricity. Everybody was experimenting with electricity back then. Michael Faraday was one of the great ones for that. He also, by the way, was one of the people who sponsored Talbot for his fellowship in the Royal Society.
Yeah.
So they were friends as well. You also get a lot of optical instruments and things. Talbot did invent a particular polarizing microscope for studying polarized light. He had done a lot of experiments with the light, along with Sir John Herschel as well.
And that would be the spectroscopy?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And we've also got a number of Egyptian stelae here, which Talbot did collect over a period of time. He was able to read hieroglyphics. He got interested in these things. He was interested in antiquarian researches. And he was one of the first people to be able to decipher Assyrian cuneiform writing as well, and translated a lot of that at the British Museum.
So where did his interest in that come from? Because that presumably would have been something that you'd have to have a spark of interest, but then have that desire to learn more. Was he making trips abroad to go and study at first hand, or was it all just out of volumes in libraries?
Well, he certainly never made it to Egypt. The farthest he got from England was a trip he made to Corfu in Greece. But I think the interest came from various different aspects. He had a classical education, like most people did at the time, most gentlemen did at the time. And a lot of that had to do with translating Greek and Latin. So I think working with different alphabets, working with different languages and things was innate to him, and he enjoyed them. He liked the puzzles that they put before him. So I think working with hieroglyphics and working with cuneiform was just another puzzle that he could work out.
So essentially it's, he had a very mathematical mind, very scientific mind, which came naturally to him. People have often said to me, as a photographer, you must have a very scientific mind. Well, I don't think of it like, or a mathematical mind, because of course it's apertures, shutter speeds, it's all different numbers. Mm-hmm. It's all ratios. But at the end of the day, if you think, if I turn the aperture ring from, say, f8 to f5.6, this is what happens. And it's a tangible, you can see in real time, well, obviously with digital, but in terms of within a matter of hours, for example, or seconds, you can see the result directly. So for him, obviously, like you say, it was innate. It was something that was a natural progress for him.
I think a lot of photographers don't realize what a close relationship they have with physics when they're working with cameras and things. Mm. It's very much a physical experiment when you're dealing with apertures and shutter speeds and things like that. And also with photography, you learn quite a bit of chemistry, whether you like it or not, whether you think you know about it or not. It's an important part, but like you say, it becomes second nature after a while. If you open the shutter up, you get more light in, so less exposure.
Yeah.
If you close the lens down, then different. Yeah. You get the opposite effect.
This is all very interesting sort of within here. I certainly wasn't aware of the hieroglyphics and certainly with the reference to electricity and that sort of experimentation. Mm. What I'd like to do now is sort of bring our conversation back to what people, listeners who maybe have a slight awareness of Fox Talbot and what have you, might have, the name might ring a bell. They may have seen some photographs and some imagery, I should say. Perhaps we could take a walk outside, mm-hmm. and we'll catch up in a few minutes and stand outside that window and continue our conversation there.
That would be great.
Lovely.
Okay.
All really fascinating stuff, and I'll be bringing you part two of our conversation in next week's podcast. You can check out all the show notes to this and other week's shows at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, don't forget I'm on Twitter at Giles Babbage. You can check out the Active Photographer Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivephotographer, or of course send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@theactivephotographer.com. So, thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, have a great week, and I will speak to you all very soon.
Member of the CurrentPhotographer.com podcast network. Find more great photography shows at CurrentPhotographer.com/podcast. CurrentPhotographer.com.